I've spent the last two decades writing about what's going to happen and talking with the most amazing human beings around the planet as to their foresight and appreciation of what's coming up this century. And that's pretty grounding. And I think my colleagues at the Natural Edge Project in our 20s and early 30s, we had to forward grieve, for want of a better expression, what's about to go down. And we're on the shallows of that, you know, swim at the moment. So as I looked to that, I realized that this decade and next for me is around those really practical ways of enabling our decision makers to make better decisions.
Hi, Smart Community friends. In this episode of the Smart Community Podcast, I have a brilliant conversation with Cheryl Desha. Cheryl tells us about her background in Mauritius and Australia and in environmental engineering, disaster management and resilience. We discuss why resilience, including digital resilience, needs to be part of the smart community conversation and how we can forward plan for better disaster management. Cheryl tells us about the ways communities often come together in practical ways after disasters and how we can continue those positive aspects of community long term. We talk about how it's important to balance the wonderful things about technology, such as data-driven decision-making and digital twins, helping us to be agile, with the way our digital junk food diet has reduced our ability to focus. Cheryl tells us about some of the projects she's been working on and some of the great books she's been reading. We finish our chat discussing the emerging trend of the need for digital resilience in the smart community space. As always, we hope you enjoy listening to this episode as much as we enjoyed making it.
Welcome to the smart community, smart regions, smart towns, and smart cities. It's where we live, work, and play. With smart communities, the future starts today. Big data, smart mobility, emerging trends galore. The Smart Community Podcast is what you're looking for.
Hello, Cheryl. How are you today?
Good. Thanks, Zoe.
I am very excited for you to be here. And I'm very excited. Well, or something. I'm really glad that we got to hang out this week in real life. It was a bit of a special surprise, actually, because I kind of, wasn't going to go. And then we were there. And then, it was great. I really, really enjoyed it. So I've been looking forward to this podcast for a long time as well. So let's just jump straight in. And can you tell us about your background and what you're passionate about?
Oh, where to start? 46, so there's a lot to talk about. The highlights, I think, from planet Earth in a little place called Mauritius. Dad's Indian Mauritian, mum's Welsh. Spent 5 years in Mauritius and then head to Australia as immigrants. So had that first generation upbringing in Australia. I have to say the community that we were amongst in Mackay in a place called Salonika Beach, went to Alligator Creek State School. How cool is that? The community there was amazing, really welcoming, and really had a blessed childhood. Went back to Mauritius quite a few times and moved down to Brisbane in southeast Queensland and have been there ever since. So I feel like I've spent a lot of my life working around the planet, a little blue marble hanging in space, and at the same time been really local to southeast Queensland. Yeah, spent a year in Japan in my teenage years, which also was pretty life-shaping in terms of learning Japanese and being over there in the 1990s where there was no internet and those little blue letters, the telegram-style letters where you have to write as tiny as you can to fit it all in. With about 4 phone calls to family over the year. So, I think those life experiences really shaped who I am. And my passion is really around having systems work, like planetary system. But as I was growing up, it was Mauritius as a system. So I could really see people were loving the island to death in the way that they were overusing stuff and not taking care of stuff. So that has been my life focus in work and in play, I think. Yeah,
excellent. Thanks so much for sharing some of that, because I think once we start to reflect on those life things that happen to us and then really life-shaping moments, I guess, or experiences that we have, we can kind of like piece back to why we think things are important and, you know, how we got to be where we are. We've done a couple of speeches together and planned some things out, and I know we were talking a lot about storytelling and how well, we told a lot of stories, right? But that there's no one path that we're going to go on. There's no path, actually. It's just like you choose your own adventure because it's not actually laid out in front of you. And I think once you start to reflect on some of those moments, you can kind of realize why you ended up in a certain spot. But also, there's so many other things that we missed that, you know, also led us to where we are today. And I think when we, you know, when we talk, we do talk a lot about that, and particularly sharing that information or sharing that knowledge, or I don't want to say wisdom, but sharing your wisdom or sharing our experiences with younger people as well. We spoke together at the ball, which I thought was really, it was really fun also.
Yes.
It was lots of fun. But also that, yeah, we need to really think about where we want to end up, but we won't necessarily end up there. And I think that's an important one of, you know, just reflecting back on where we're going. But I also want the audience to know, what do you do now and how did you end up, I guess, in the role you're in now?
Yeah, great segue. I was just thinking as you were speaking, my, you know, that one step in front of the other. When I was at high school, I really didn't enjoy doing maths or problem solving in that way, but I was doing it in a lot of other ways. And I think as soon as it got into letters rather than numbers, because I still really can't add up very well, but the algebra and those proofs around being able to get to the source of something that's repeatable really intrigued me, that there were these patterns around us that human beings had kind of stumbled upon, like the Fibonacci sequence and other things like that. They were just so beautiful that we could learn and then use elsewhere. So that set me on a course of environmental engineering and, you know, to do infrastructure work rather than to deal with people. I think so. In my base thought going through life has been, the world is full of stupids for whatever reason. Like, why do people make these silly mistakes or silly decisions around pollution, around waste, around trashing things? And so my first part of my career was doing engineering, like green infrastructure and sustainable development through that, through working at ARUP and then into the university sector at Griffith QUT and then back to Griffith. More recently, I'd say the last decade, I've been doing a lot more work with human beings. And of course, we're not all silly or stupid. Well, sometimes we can be. We still make decisions that we sometimes look back and think, why on earth did that happen? But generally speaking, I think my journey more recently has been one of supporting people to make better decisions and with an environmental grounding. So that's about environmental engineering in the past has been about designing out waste for me and designing out pollution so we don't have to deal with it. But more recently, it's been in the world of disaster management and resilience. So, you know, as we look ahead over the next 20 years, I think I've spent the last two decades writing about what's going to happen and talking with the most amazing human beings around the planet as to their foresight and appreciation of what's coming up this century. And that's pretty grounding. And I think my colleagues at the Natural Edge Project in our 20s and early 30s, we had to forward grieve, for want of a better expression, what's about to go down. And we're on the shallows of that, you know, swim at the moment. So as I looked to that, I realized that, you know, this decade and next for me is around those really practical ways of enabling our decision makers to make better decisions in a way that's not too fatiguing, that uses what we call augmented intelligence rather than artificial intelligence. So AI, yeah, but augmented intelligence with computing support where needed and some really cool academic think tanks where needed so that we can continue towards doing sustainable development work in the face of ongoing adversity and like new normal next level adversity in terms of climate change impacts that we've already put in place. Yeah, can't do much about them, but we can live through them and mitigate further and hopefully pop out the other side of that not whole, not too bruised or scarred, yeah?
Yeah, and I'm keen to, I guess, get into that in a bit more detail. And I guess one of the biggest things for smart communities is that resilience has to be part of that conversation, and not just the conversation, but the action behind it as well. And I think that's what's going to really set smart communities apart from ones that aren't so smart or are still on the being on the journey. It's all a journey. It's not necessarily that an end product as we talk about, but the ones that are more resilient and more resilient in terms of preparation, but prevention, using resources more effectively, more efficiently. But then if we do have to bounce back or build back or come back, that we can do that in a quicker way as well. That is also equitable and inclusive? Because something I've been thinking about a lot, it's like, well, okay, that's fine if, you know, the people that, I don't know, were able to buy on the top of the hill are fine, but how do we make sure that everybody can get back to their normal day-to-day, or just, you know, getting out of survival mode, I suppose, as quickly as possible with the efficient, like with the resources that we have available? How do we make sure we're using them the most effectively for the human beings that are living in our communities?
Yeah.
But before we dive into a bit more of what your area is, let's go broader to what is a smart community to you?
Oh, yeah, great question, because I know in your podcast I had so many different people with different ideas around it. It's been really interesting to listen to that. I think where I find myself landing for a smart community conversation is twofold, and it's possibly going on from that story I was just sharing before about my split brain personality around I don't think I mentioned Dad's a civil engineer and Mum's an occupational therapist. So half my life I spend thinking about infrastructure and the other half I spend thinking about people, I think. So I think for me, smart community is one that's physically linked really well and relationally linked really well. So relationships in terms of that community social infrastructure, and then the physical infrastructure that works really well. And I put on top of that nature-inspired and nature-loving. So nature-inspired in terms of the biomimetic properties that we can embed into social networks and physical network, physical infrastructure, and nature's, the amazing attributes we see in nature with that bounce back and finding new normals and finding beauty and joy in those new normals. When you think about forests regrowing after a fire, they haven't gone back to being the previous forest. They've become another version of that forest that's just as beautiful to walk in. And yeah, it's not the same as it was before. It's a new normal. So that nature inspired, and then nature loving, like physically just having more nature in and around our built environments just has to be good for us. All the literature points to that. All of the psychology points to that. So nature loving, nature inspired, I think is also, you know, they're really good indicators for smart community.
I love that. And thanks. I think you've given us a really great snapshot of all of those different pieces that kind of fit together and have to fit together for smart communities. And I do love the nature inspired. Well, I love that term, actually. It's really nice. But also, I just, you know, when you were talking, envisage this leafy green kind of area, but it will be different. And I do, and just that new normal, I was trying to articulate that before, but you did it so well with the forest. Like, it was amazing. So like just thinking about, okay, well, when we go through things, we don't come out the same person at the other side, but we come back as this is a different normal, a different person, a different thing, but we hopefully learn from that experience and that we can still be just as beautiful on the other side as well.
Yeah.
But that doesn't just happen, right? Like it's sometimes, you know, even in nature, things go the wrong way, particularly when humans are involved. And yeah, so it's actually about using the information, the knowledge we have to make those decisions as best that we can with the knowledge we have available at the time. And we just have so much more knowledge available now, and we can dive deep into the archives of the people that have been here for a very long time, our First Nations people. But we can then augment that with the data that we have available, the computing technology that we have available, the things that we've learned since then as well. And I think that's really important. And I bring that up because I know that's something you're very passionate about as well.
Yes, I was just having a mull as you were talking there around a more recent exploration for me. And yet, you know, sometimes you learn, you realize something, you think, why on earth didn't I think about that before? I had that moment about 6 years ago with a colleague, Tim Forsman, who entered my life while I was at QUT as a professor at the time. And he is a geospatial fiend. Like, he just loves everything to do with cartography and where things are. And I just had this hammer in the head moment that, oh my goodness, my whole career I've been talking about sustainable development. I really haven't focused on where being critical. And for communities, of course, that's an epitome of that conversation, that where is absolutely critical. So that's been my journey in terms of this digital geospatial, what we call digital earth, in understanding more about that data. And sometimes data can just sit there as white noise. How do you make that useful, like really meaningful information? as digital earth to then help us move forward. So the digital earth, digital twins, all that kind of stuff that can help our human brains think more clearly and more strategically about decision-making. Yeah, that really intrigues me. More recently, I've had another hammer in the head moment, Zoe, and it's been around the reality that we all rely so much on our smart technology and real-time sensor feeds and Wi-Fi, that when we are in a situation of adversity, whether it's flooding, fire, or a solar flare, which would knock out all of our telco, by the way, like it's a really big deal. When we get a solar flare, then that digital resilience becomes a really, really interesting conversation. So how do we forward plan digital resilience to help us during response and recovery? And there's been some really interesting conversations, again, at the community level around, you know what, near enough might be good enough in those circumstances. So if we can do some forward scenario planning and have in the top drawer local data on a local USB or a local hard drive, that, or even printouts, heaven forbid, that we have to hand, and strategies for dealing in a world absent of digital support for a while, then that's probably a good thing in terms of that forward intelligence that you were speaking of. So yes, long wisdom in terms of Indigenous culture and knowing place. Yes, more recent knowledge around cool maths and data that gives us better sensing in addition to our eyes and ears and our five senses. And then also this forward planning to say, when we don't have the extra backup that we've come to rely on almost without thinking, then that will have us not fall so hard during that incident. Yeah. So that's been a hammer in the head. I'm like, why didn't I think about that before? Maybe more people should think about that.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think it's a really interesting one. It's doing that forward thinking, but then we're saying that the future is not going to be the same as it is now. We can shape it and all those type of things. But if we have this, you know, big, massive thing that happens to us, we won't have the things that we have available now. What's our backup for that? And we may, you know, it goes then go to critical services and all those type of things as well. But I think what, like as you were speaking there, I was thinking, you know, if we can build up those other resilience pieces, like you were talking about, the physical and the human, then we can, you know, if we lose the digital, we've got those other things. So we know that, okay, well, I can get here, I can talk to this person, I can do these things, I've built these relationships. And then we go back to, you know, whatever we were using beforehand. But then how do we can get that? Because we know that the digital is necessary. We know that the technology and data is helping us and they're tools, right? And how we can, I guess, get it back as quickly as possible. But we've got those other things that we need to rely on, or that we rely on as well, which is what the smart community builds on, that approach builds on. And I think it's also around, okay, well, we have to adapt to change. Whatever happens, we have to adapt to change. And I think if we are able to do that, the quicker we can do that, the more, you know, when we see something's happening and we have all the information, the data to make that decision, then we can actually enact change and adapt to that and build those mindsets that we use the resources that we have available.
Mm, yeah. You know, when we have those big incidents and we're in Southeast Queensland, so we're a hotspot inside a hotspot. Like we're a hotspot in Queensland for disasters. In Australia, we catch around 2/3 of the disasters as a state. So we're pretty used to things going a bit AWOL and then coming back from that. And in Queensland, there's been quite a bit of experiences of what we call natural law returning after an event. So, you know, once you get an impact, say, for example, floods in Southeast Queensland, and people were without power and water and whatever else for up to a week or sometimes more in Brisbane, people banded together in ways that they hadn't done for decades and created their own little co-ops where they were food sharing and bartering, created their own micro-grid communities, you know, whether it was someone who happened to have a generator, as it wasn't necessarily renewable power, but it was still this community-based existence that returned. And some of the research that's come out of that, with asking people to reflect back on that experience and how they felt, people were reflecting that they actually felt alive And yeah, the disaster was challenging to deal with in terms of the grieving around property and also people and pets and livestock. And inside that, there was this sense of vitality and being alive in getting to make their own decisions as a local community. And then you see, you know, a month or 2 months after that, this return to a more abstracted, distant governance model again. And that side of life disappears. And so I just wonder whether we couldn't have more of that natural law remaining long-term when we think forward about imagining smart communities in future. Perhaps those windows that we have straight after disasters are giving us a little reminder that life's a bit more exciting when we get to make up our own way of being at a community level. And actually, we get joy from that and satisfaction from that. And that intrigues me because my split brain goes, the side that's an engineer says, no, that creates disorder and chaos. And how on earth do we govern that? And then the human side of my brain goes, oh, that would be so much enjoyable and creative. So I don't know where to go with that. But it's quite interesting to see the difference in people's sense of satisfaction.
Yeah, I kind of swing between the two as well. Like, oh, that's nice. Oh, no, but we need rigor and standards.
Order. We need order.
We must have order. But I think, like you said, it makes people feel alive because they're no longer on autopilot, right? You can't just get up, you know, jump in the car, drive to work, park, you know, like it's completely, you can't just, yeah, you have to think about what the next step is and what the best next step is, or maybe it's not the best, but the only one available at the time. And then also thinking about your neighbors and that they may not be able to make those decisions. So how can we help them to do that with the resources that we have available, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, you're not going to, unlikely you're going to say, oh no, I'm just here. Like I can't help any of you people. Yes, we're all flooded, but surely we'll just work it out. You have to work together. And I found a lot of that when I lived in regional Australia, growing up in regional Australia. Not just in times of disaster, definitely, but just in regular times, because you kind of are living with less, you know, services, less resources, less opportunities potentially as well. So people, and, you know, everyone knows you. So you're nearly forced into being a community, for want of a better word, but everyone knows you. So like, you know, I used to work at the Chinese restaurant and I used to live about 5K out of town. And so I could walk on, you know, not regularly, but if I really wanted to. But my parents would finish work or whatever. I start at 5:30, they'd finish 5, something like along those lines. So I would start walking along the road and one of my neighbors would likely be driving down the road and then they'd give me a lift in. And I, you know, otherwise my parents would, whichever way it worked, if they got to me first or my neighbors, you know, got to me, I'd get a lift in until I got my license, which was just the, you know, such freedom after that time being in a small regional town. But yeah, and that was just a, you know, that was a normal thing. Or a few people would pull over and be, oh, how do you need to live from? Oh, no, you know, mum's coming, whatever the case is. And similarly on the way home, not at night time, but, you know, if one of us was, one of the parents was coming, they'd drop us off or whatever if it's on the way. But I just think there's a few, like, I definitely felt that in regional. And then in cities, what I find is you find your own little community, which they may not be geographically close to you, but you might all meet occasionally, or it's online, or it's, there's a common interest there. Whereas I found in regional, you just had to, it wasn't necessarily someone with the exact same interest as you. But yeah, it was like you were there, you were, have your, yeah, that geographic kind of space. But yeah, in cities I've found, and you know, I guess it depends when you get older and your stage of life and all those types of things as well. But yeah, I do think that there's something in that for sure.
Yeah. I've just finished reading a book, Zoe, and it's called Stolen Focused by Johan Hari. And I think that might be a game changer for me. And I'm still, you know, working through the somewhat confronting reality that he paints in that book. It's around our ability to do what you're talking about and the shifting reality of that with the distractions that are around us every day and increasing. And I've always been an advocate of data and digital twins and digital intelligence. You know, at at Griffith, we have a couple of MOUs with industry partners around software design, and we're actively encouraging students to learn how to learn. So how do you pick up that technology and become agile in picking up other technology that looks like it, so that you are really aware of the assumptions that are embedded in it, because it's been designed by human beings with algorithms and decision points, many base layers of legislation that might not be appropriate to where you are, and you need to be mindful, all that kind of stuff around handling technology wisely. But Johan talks about the reality that our experience with technology as a human being has left us a little bit like eating too much junk food, which I did yesterday at the ECCA, the Royal Exhibition. So I'm feeling the effects of that right now physically. But a digital junk food experience where our ability to focus is gone, like shattered, and it's returnable if we focus on it. But the reality is that there's no one telling us that it is a problem or that we should focus on it. So that distracted mindset doesn't seek out community. The distracted mindset seeks out the next hit of pleasure. And that pleasure is inevitably via checking in on Facebook or Insta or looking at the latest YouTube or TikTok. That's short-lived, short bursts, but it's like empty calories for the brain is how I think of it. And it's not just kids. We always say, oh, kids have too much tech these days. They've got too much screen time. But actually, adults have too much tech these days and too much screen time, not in the way that we're talking about tech for a community building sense, but at a very individual level. I think it's robbing us of the time that we used to take to create community. And it's robbing our kids now of even getting that childhood experience of community. And that's really unsettling for my engineering brain and my social brain. So I think there's going to have to be some reconciling of that problem, like soon, imminently, because his book came out last year. It's a very current topic, and it's a hockey stick, like a rapidly escalating problem that's actually resulting real time in poor academic performance, poor creative performance, poor social interactions. And ultimately, if we don't have community, we don't have society, it's pointless trying to do things around sustainable development and resilience, because we can't even be civil to each other or look out for each other and make sensible decisions that take time, you know. So I think that's my concern point at the moment in terms of smart communities, that smart communities need individuals inside the communities who are paying attention.
Mm. Yeah, I totally agree with you. And I think it's something that, again, we use technology as a tool. And if the tool is no longer serving us in the way it was meant to, what are we going to do about it? How are we going to shift and change? And it does, it falls back onto the individual. But if we don't realize it's a problem or we don't recognize that, then we're not going to shift or do it differently. I do think, yeah, the ability to think creatively, if we don't have time to think, then really, yeah, we're going to end up, and we need to think creatively because we need to come up with new solutions, because the ones that we've got are not necessarily serving us how we need them to, or they need to be built upon. We need people not to just to, you know, what's the next video, but we need people to think, oh, what could we do with, you know, this thing that doesn't have a real answer right now, or has a really complex, nuanced, gray answer that does not fit very, you know, doesn't fit into the, I don't know, the agenda, the, I'm just thinking politically now, but like the left or the right wing agenda, but actually it's a conversation that needs to happen with all parties. And the polarization, I think it also causes that polarization. It's like, no, this is good or bad. And obviously there are some things that are very bad and some things that are, that we don't want to be encouraging or whatever, but there's always so much nuance in it. I think that we are, somewhere along the way, we've lost that ability to actually have those real conversations without the worry of, or just the reality of, I guess, getting to a solution that we can actually move forward with, where everyone doesn't have to agree or everyone's not, you know, on one side of the fence or the other, because there's many spaces in between.
Zoe, have you ever heard, I hadn't heard of this, and it was before Johan's book. There was one other that I'll bring up in this conversation that, in a really good way, like it's a good news story, His name's Tyson Yonker-Porter, and he's from Deakin Uni, and he wrote a book called Sand Talk. And Amazon, I think, even has it free at the moment. Like, it's out there and able to be easily read. And it's an Indigenous-led conversation, so Aboriginal conversation in Australia, gathering the yarning from a fair few aunties and one in particular that he's documented. And Tyson talks about the reality that forever, like, human beings have had this oral culture where we yarn and we tell stories and we tell them repeatedly, and those yarnings, the story is essentially the same. But with each generation telling the story, the context changes. So I don't know, it's a little bit like the forest example that we talked about before. The forest rejuvenates and it's never quite the same, but it retains that identity as forest. And over time, if climate conditions change, it might go from being a tropical rainforest to a savanna. It still has, you know, the bones of the essential identity as a green space, yeah? So in a yarning sense, the story might change in terms of the way it's said, but the original meaning is retained to a degree in over multiple generations. And he talks about most recently around Industry 4.0 and all those other cool things since the Industrial Revolution, we've shifted a lot to being a written culture where we write things down. And in the writing things down, maybe over the last couple of thousand years, even in some parts of the world, in writing it down, the writing gets stuck at the time that it was written. And then it's an interpretation, but we keep interpreting going back to that piece of writing that was at that particular point written down. Like, oh, that's really intriguing, because it doesn't give us the flexibility that yarning does in adapting with each time that it's said to the current context. We keep, you know, bouncing back to that original piece. And he has a great way of talking about how we can integrate more of that yarning talking culture into creative thinking going forward and create artifacts. So, you know, Aborigines have beautiful produced pieces that when they are described and shared from generation to generation, each picture or component of that artifact has stored knowledge. And I didn't understand that. The book has helped me understand it a lot more. And I think, oh, I wonder whether there's that part to community. Could we, for example, in my local community here in Brizzy, are there any artifacts that I would point to that were the yarning of my local area in Brisbane? No, there's nothing. There's even at a national level, I think, what artifact would I point to that has embedded in it a yarning of my experience of Australia? I'm like, I can't really point to anything really. I mean, we've got coins and money and the coat of arms and a few other bits and pieces. So, yeah, I wonder whether smart community also has perhaps an artifact, or at least an oral yarning about it that has that richness, because that's what a smart community would do in ensuring that future generations understood that big flood and what happened in our local area, or that big fire and what we did about it, that transcends the digital reliance that, oh, if it's not on a USB stick or if we haven't put it in a book somewhere, then we're in strife. It's like, well, no, as long as people are around, then the message gets transmitted.
That's really interesting. I'm going to have to put these books on my reading list as well. And I think that's really important. It also just goes to that conversation. Like, obviously we're on a podcast, we're having a conversation, we're going to record it, it's going to be around for a while. But I don't know, just the process of having this conversation is part of, you know, building community. It's part of my community. And that's why I find when I have these conversations, it's most of the time the best part of my week, where I can, you know, there's no real, like, the outcome of this is that we have a conversation and we put it out there or whatever, but actually you don't have to say this, or we don't have to come to a conclusion. We just finish the conversation. And I think that's also really important when we are pressed very much for that end result. What's next? What's next? What's next? Like you were talking about earlier. So yeah, I think it's definitely an interesting one. Now, we will go to the future, but do you want to share any projects that you're working on currently before we head to the future?
Ooh, yes. So a couple of projects. So one infrastructure project that's just about to start is around using that digital intelligence, the data intelligence, some really smart people inside the university have got a great model that when cyclones hit the coastline, that combines with the information about the cyclone, combines with data around sea level changes with just tidal changes with moon and sea level rise, and all of that gets computed into this forward intelligence around whether there might be storm surge along the coastline. And that can then give people a day or perhaps even more notice so that there can be a really orderly, she says, a really nice, like, organized retreat in anticipation of that incident, rather than it being one of those emergency rescue response horrible experiences that we've had in the past. So reducing the pain point of cyclones hitting the coastline is one of the projects that I'm part of that bigger team working on it. Another one that's just about to start, another one is around developing an app. You're like, oh, no, not another app. But she says, because she's passionate about it, it's a cool one around helping what we call transient populations. So people who are returning home intermittently or tourists on one of our islands in Southeast Queensland, North Stradbroke Island, Minjeriba, and enabling some artifacts via that app that help people understand the local environment, the local culture, and also be prepared in case there is an incident or a disaster while they're on the island, what they can do. So again, bringing down the potential pain point of the incident. And hopefully that can become a template then for nationally, for any local government who needs some sort of digital scaffold or digital base to do that similar kind of app for people passing through their area, that they would know what to do if there was a flood or a fire or lack of telco coverage for a while, and help the local councils as well as help the visitors coming through feel more supported and able just to enjoy their experience without having that background worry. Yeah, so they're two cool projects. I actually have, at the moment, we're with the Natural Hazards Research Australia, our PhD team inside the uni has this really great idea. They've just got through to the finals. So that October the 13th is International Disaster Resilience Day. Woo! Way to celebrate disasters, but that should be fun. And there's a conference in Brisbane. So they're about to pitch what they're calling a beacon of hope. And it's a community artifact that they're creating a template for, where local communities come together through a series of workshops and co-design and co-create an artifact that tells stories going about what needs to be done in future and what's happened in the past to their local community, where they can physically rally around in the event of a disaster and also use as that oral yarning of what needs to be done, you know, should something happen again. So I'm super excited about that. I don't know where it's going to go, you know, wearing mentor hat, and what a pragmatic way of dealing with what we've been talking about. So it's a bit of fun.
Yeah, love that. All of those sounds super interesting and super different as well, but also like bringing it back to that core of resilience and, you know, sustainability, like we were just talking about. So no, thanks for sharing that. I'm glad that we got to talk about some of your projects. Let's zoom to the future. What are the emerging trends that people aren't talking about enough?
Oh, I think there are two. One of them we've spoken about. So I think it's our dive in focus as individuals and alongside the digitally, there's a lot of reasons why we're losing focus. One of them's digital, another one's diet, another one's lack of sleep, and another one is prolonged stress. And, you know, we've talked before COVID and other disasters, we used to talk about stress just being because you work too much. But actually at the moment, our decision makers are really tired, really tired. Even, I mean, locally in Queensland, for example, our state disaster centre has been on, so activated, I think nearly 4 years. And they've stopped counting how many days it's been on without break. It's just the new normal is that it's always on. What does that mean for workforce? What does that mean for resourcing response and strategic planning? Well, that's a whole new conversation. So that new normal requires new business strategies for private sector and public sector. So I think it's definitely one that needs more conversation. And I think that does enable ultimately that smart community outcome, because it's not just about putting the hose to the fire in front of you. It's actually looking beyond that, you know, metaphorically, to what's happening over the hill, sometimes to the side and behind you as well. So having that time to look up, look out is definitely something that needs more conversation. And I think perhaps the other one is that digital resilience conversation definitely needs more of that, because too often I'm sitting in conferences and workshops where people talk about the solve-all piece of software that can provide real-time decision support in the moment so we don't have to worry. And the alarm bell just goes off in my head that says, what happens if that's not there? Because, you know, if you put all your eggs in one basket and that basket gets dropped, all the eggs break and then you're left with nothing. So yes, that's great. And what a fantastic opportunity to use that. And what's our contingency plan for digital failure during disasters? So I think that conversation definitely requires more airspace.
Yeah, I agree. And like the connectivity can be different things that we're than what we're used to. And I guess what I'm trying to say is, you know, we might not be able to make a phone call or get a text message, but really small packets of data might be able to be sent over a different level of connectivity. And so what does that look like? And then how do we know about it? Like, you know, that you need to do the scenarios, like you said, and training. It's like, okay, well, what information is super critical at this time? Okay, well, we need to know if, I don't know, there's anybody in that building. So maybe it is like people sensor or whatever, and it can go over whatever network it is that won't go down during a solar flare.
Yeah. Or is it sight lines? If we have sight lines, okay, where geographically do we have sight lines in our local city? And what tops of what buildings would we use and set up with sightline correspondence, whether it's and do that accordingly? I mean, you know what? Less than 60 years ago, we used that regularly. In World War II, Morse code and other forms of communication worked quite fine, thank you very much, with very short turnaround times of minutes to be able to get conversations over very long distances. So we kind of have a little chuckle about those these days, but actually they were very effective.
For the time.
For the time. Smoke signals, flares, you know, mirrors, whatever. But to be prepared for that, as, you know, in back pocket, I'm a girl guide, so, you know, be prepared, kind of my daily mantra. Much to the annoyance of family and friends at times, but I think having that just drops the stress levels and actually helps us to have more fun and enjoy life because we know we've got it covered. So, yeah, that's my looking forward.
I think that's important too because, you know, I was obviously talking about a digital connection, but actually it's not necessarily digital. If all of that goes, to say everything goes down, what are the other things that need to be in place?
Yours would be a great plan B if there was limited or some residual.
Yeah, like you could, you know, step down the hierarchy of.
But you know what? Solar flare, and I'm the biggest fan of electric vehicles and all the rest, but solar flare, what does that actually knock out? Are we left with lawnmowers as being the only thing that actually can get power?
Hey, my lawnmower is electric. Thank you very much. Oh,
there we go. So you can't mow your lawn. Well, not such a bad thing. Yeah. So looking ahead and being creative. And, you know, in Blues, we call it one of my colleagues, Lisa Sisson. She's written a book called Risk Starts and Ends with People, which is kind of my mindset these days. And that's her conversation, I think, in my head. It's always about, well, if you can just do blue sky planning, like do this kind of thinking when it is sunshine outside or nothing, no crisis is going on, we can have a giggle and a laugh and but still create some really good plans. And then we know what can happen.
Yeah, I think it's just ideas too. Like, okay, we might laugh at that, but then just say the disaster happened. Oh, but actually Cheryl said we should use this. I mean, it was weird at the time, but let's just see if it works. Oh, wait, it does.
Let's have a crack.
Okay. Well, Cheryl, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast. I've loved this conversation and I love every conversation that we have, actually. No pressure for the future conversations. But I just have one last question, which is how can people connect with you?
Oh, I am part of the Focus Rebellion that Johan has talked about in his book. So email, I've come to terms with the reality that email was great in the 2000s, but just like beta videos and other things, it's had its time. So actually really love LinkedIn as the best way to communicate, you know, short conversations via some text initially. And then if we catch up in person after that, then so be it. So feel free to connect via LinkedIn. Anybody who knows me knows that the email will end up in an inbox that is searchable, which is fantastic as an archive of stuff that's happened, but not a great communication device.
Yes, I have learned such a thing. But we've worked away, we've worked the channels, we've worked, you know, I just send you a text. Hey, I sent you this email. You have to click the link so that we can book in a podcast, you know?
Thank you, Zoe. Thank you. Thank you for being part of my rebellion.
No worries. No, I totally agree with you. I need to have some creative thinking time about email. But yeah, thanks again for coming onto the pod. We'll put all links in the show notes so people can click away and find you. I love this conversation and I'm sure the audience will get some really great nuggets of gold out of it. So thanks again. And I look forward to our next one.
Thank you so much, Zoe. You're a legend.
We'll talk soon.
Okay. Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Are you looking for an engaging speaker, MC, or facilitator for your next big event? Then we've got you covered. Zoe is a go-to speaker, MC, and conversation facilitator with a difference. She's a master at simplifying the complex and making connections you might never see. Book Zoe for your next event. Email hello@mysmart.community or head over to her speaker page, www.mysmart.community/speaking.
Thanks so much for listening to the Smart Community Podcast. Show notes for this episode and all other episodes are available on our website, mysmart.community/podcast. If you have any questions for us or any of our guests, you can email hello@mysmart.community. You can also find us on the socials. We are on LinkedIn and Twitter @smartcomhq. That's com with two M's. If you are enjoying the podcast, please hit subscribe so you never miss an episode. And we would love for you to leave us a rating and review at wherever you listen. This really helps us reach more ears and eyes, so thank you for your support. As always, we hope you enjoyed listening to this episode as much as we enjoyed making it.
The Smart Community Podcast is what you're looking for.